Hello and welcome to Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Well, we've all drudged our way through the January blues, but Gordon Brown's had it bluer than most. A whole run of polls have shown Labour's on the slide. And in today's show, we'll ask if there's anything at all the Prime Minister can do to stop the rot. Four Lords caught a leaping in return for a fee, or at least, so it's alleged. We debate how to wash the stain of sleaze away from Parliament's upper house. And finally, we learnt yesterday that senior bankers have been pitching the case for a rise. As belts tighten all round, we'll ask what should be done to stop the fat cats from hogging the cream. Joining me to consider these matters are three stars of the Guardian Galaxy. Our head of politics, Will Woodward. The leading lady of social democracy, author and columnist, Polly Toynbee. And blogosphere supremo, Matt Seaton, the editor of Comment is Free. Hello all, and in the midst of this grey winter of discontent, I do hope you're retaining good spirits. Gordon Brown, from zero to hero, but now sliding rapidly back towards zero again. Five straight opinion polls have now shown that the brief brown bounce in the autumn has given way to brown backlash, with the Tories surging ahead by an average of 12 points, and in the Guardian's own poll this week, they even grabbed a lead on running the economy. One Guardian columnist thinks it's because the PM is without any plan.
I think never since I've been involved in or interested in politics and economics has there been such total confusion as to what the government should be doing, the country should be doing, and you sense this floundering all the time, intellectual floundering. People really don't know what to do, and every week the government comes up with some new plan, and it seems to fail, and people really have no response to that. It's a very interesting period intellectually.
Simon Jenkins. As Chancellor, he always pulled rabbits from out of his hat on Budget Day. But Polly Toynbee, does Gordon Brown have any more tricks up his sleeve?
I think it's very difficult because even if his plans work really well, and probably even if organisations like the OECD or the IFS say after a year perhaps that what Britain did was the right thing, we're still going to be in a bad situation and nobody's going to know exactly or be able to quantify exactly what effect it had. We'll be left with large debts, and he may say, and even the experts may say, it would have been a hell of a lot worse if he hadn't done what he did. But it's not provable and it may not convince the voters. That's his problem. I think probably we'll see right across the world a lot of governments in deep trouble over the next year. One prime minister's fallen already. My guess is it's very hard to get re-elected in really bad times.
And do you think that's right, Will Woodward, especially now that the IMF is saying that Britain's going to take more of a battering than any other economy?
No, I think that was a really devastating piece of news because Brown has for some time relied on the big reports, the judgment of the international community to validate what he's doing. And I have to say, the Davos summit, which he's going to at the end of the week, couldn't really come at a worse time. I mean, you know, maybe Brown should have said, well, you know what, I'm not going to go to Davos, so I'm not going to do my kind of thinking up there, as it were, at an elevated level. I'll spend the weekend in South Wales.
Matt Seaton, I wonder, after hearing yesterday, the IFS think tank said that whoever wins the next election, there's going to have to be tax rises now and spending cuts of £20 billion on top of what the government's already planned. Could Labour take comfort in the thought that this might be a good one to lose?
That's having to take a very long view, isn't it? I don't think any incoming government is facing a kind of good position at all. I mean, you know, I don't think the Tories have got a great plan, but I think they're in a position of just being able to sit there and take advantage of the fact that Gordon, you know, all the news in the next sort of year, 15 months, is going to be very bad. But yes, I mean, I think it's going to take probably 4 or 5 years to pull out of this. You wouldn't really want to be having to run the economy through to 2012.
No, you sort of think no one who's sane enough to do the job well would probably want it. I mean, Polly, do you think there can be an election that's a good election to lose?
Perhaps if Labour were to lose it by a whisker, if there were to be a hung parliament with the Lib Dems, between the Conservatives and the Lib Dems, and at last the Lib Dems got their PR, their proportional representation. That's a dream scenario, impossible to vote for, impossible to predict, and frankly unlikely. The hung parliament has been predicted many a time and very, very rarely happens. In that scenario, I think Labour would be well out of it for 4 years. You'd have a new voting system, and you'd never again get one party in power. You wouldn't get this pendulum swing. I think that would be very good for British politics, but Highly unlikely, but it's the only good scenario. Otherwise, it's never good to lose an election.
Martin Kettle wrote recently about the sense that Brown sort of consciously is delaying the election, partly for reasons of posterity, that he didn't go early in 2007 because he didn't want to be a very short-term prime minister, and having 3 years sounded better than 6 months.
And I think he does hope something will turn up. People always do. And after all, the original prediction from the Treasury was that things would get better halfway through this year. Looks pretty thin now. But the predictions are such rubbish anyway. You have to remember the OECD, who this week said we were virtually the worst in the world, barring basket cases, Japan and Italy, is also the same OECD that only a year ago called us the Goldilocks economy. Not too hot, not too cold, absolutely perfect, what the rest of the world should be following. Did they see us as a great big dangerous bubble? Not a bit of it. So we'd be a little wary of forecasts at the moment, I think.
In terms of what would happen if Labour lost the election, and how, I mean, clearly it's bad news for Gordon Brown to lose the election, even if he gets through to 2010 and can say he's done 3 years, Matt Seaton, but an awful lot would then depend, wouldn't it, on whether Labour tears itself to pieces or whether it gets behind a new person, I suppose.
Yes, and, you know, one cannot be terribly confident about Labour's ability to renew itself at the moment. I mean, one of its problems, I think, leading up to the kind of credit crunch was it was beginning to look intellectually tired and was running thin on new ideas. And whether it will have the sort of capacity to do that kind of rebuilding. It's also a very hollowed out party, I think. I mean, you know, none of the parties are in a terribly healthy state in terms of their grassroots. But I think Labour's sort of bigger activist problem than most now.
I think it would build pretty quickly, though, because I think what you'd find is a Conservative Party coming in say, 2010, will be in such deep trouble. It will have to make huge cuts in services and huge, you know, it won't be able to make big tax cuts. People will really feel the pinch. I mean, whoever's in power. But Labour suddenly has a real cause at that point. This is back to the 1980s, Mrs. Thatcher's notorious budget of 1981. It's going to feel like that again. And I have a feeling that'll have a rallying effect on a lot of the people who've left Labour coming back again.
Cash for questions we're used to, but this week's row has been about cash for changing the law. Simon Hoggart, the Guardian sketch writer, explains the mess.
The suggestion, the allegation that at least four peers, Labour peers in the House of Lords, have been prepared to, and indeed have in the past been accepting money in order to influence legislation. Well, this is a very, very, very serious charge, but of course, peers, even though they're life peers, all four of them, they're people who are usually backbench Labour MPs at one time, or junior ministers. Now their peers, they're subject to the same rules that date back, frankly, to the times of Henry II and Richard III, when you basically couldn't get rid of a peer, or at least you could by hanging him, and no one's suggesting that. So there's actually, technically, no way you can get rid of a peer who has been behaving in what may be a very outrageous fashion. They're defending themselves very strongly. I went into the House of Lords on Monday. Two of them stood up, Lord Snape and Lord Taylor, to say that they felt they'd done nothing wrong at all.
If I have done anything that has brought this House into disrepute, I must humbly apologise.
So we'll see, but there's no doubt at all that peers in particular are outraged, appalled and rather frightened. One of the themes that kept coming up in their short debate on Monday was we've been demeaned in the eyes of the world, as if the great British House of Lords, always a model of propriety and decency, had been caught with their hands in the till, rather as if it turned out that Mother Teresa had a career as a fan dancer. My suspicion, and it's only a suspicion, is that all four peers who fell for the honey trap will, in the end, for one reason or another, have to leave because the peers are so terrified of losing their reputation for integrity.
Matt Seaton, I'd say it's actually more shocking than discovering that Mother Teresa's got a sideline in erotic dance.
Well, perhaps we shouldn't be so shocked. I mean, I think we've got very used to worrying about MPs' expenses and a declaration of MPs' interests. And we've sort of taken our eye off the ball and it didn't occur to us to have a look at what the Lords were up to. And it does seem to me that this sort of symptomatic of the fact that in the end, the sort of promised Blair reform of the House of Lords, which was never more than partial and essentially unfinished, has left us with the vulnerability that we've seen this week.
Will, can you just fill us in a bit on what the rules are meant to be? I mean, it seems to me staggering. We heard Lord Tyler there saying, you know, I'm terribly sorry, if I humbly apologise if I've done anything at all wrong. And he was caught on tape talking about some extraordinary amounts of money, tens and hundreds of thousands of pounds he thought he got off companies. Is there any reading of the rules on which he could have been on the right side of them?
Well, I mean, it's difficult because they are allowed to work for lobbying firms. They are allowed to have outside interests. They don't get paid a salary. And yet, you know, seeing as I knew you were going to ask me this, I've got the code of conduct here from March 2002, and it says members of the House must never accept any financial inducement as an incentive or reward for exercising parliamentary influence. And later on, holders of public office should not place themselves under any financial or other obligation to outside individuals or organisations that might influence in the performance of their official duties. Well, given that they're being employed by these firms because they're in the House of Lords and for no other reason, I mean, these people really are of limited value to them if they're not in the Lords. I simply don't accept that there's a sort of, these people would be marketable otherwise. The code, on sort of blanket terms, does appear to rule out lobbying. And yet, as I say, you know, the other bits of the rules say they are allowed to work for lobbying companies.
So a bit of confusion there. But do you think it's case closed, Polly Toynbee?
Yeah, I think this is a mortal blow for the Lords. They've always said, you know, we're so wonderful. We have such fantastic debates. We're full of experts and serious people who really know about things in the world. Actually, it's full of a lot of deadbeat politicians who were absolute rubbish in the Commons. Their parties wanted their seats, so booted them up. Says them. Someone like Lewis Mooney. The idea of him in ermine is ludicrous. So it's rather satisfying when they're caught doing what we have to remember human beings always do. If they have the opportunity to steal and filch and cheat, they will. And everything, whether it's banks, companies, or politics, requires transparency and regulation. And if you don't have that, in the end, some people will cheat and defraud the system. And that's why, you know, we need to have much greater transparency everywhere. You need to know what people are up to.
So Polly thinks it's transparency, Matt. You were talking about wider issues of reform. One thing I've wondered about is it this question Will was saying these people aren't getting paid a salary? Is it simply that they're not paid and so they go around and try and make money in dodgy ways instead?
Well, I mean, that's a bit like sort of party funding, isn't it? That perhaps we need a professional class of politicians in the second chamber. That may be part of it. I also think we've got a sort of unfinished democratic revolution, and we really need to have an elected second chamber.
They could still be sleazy if we elected them, right?
Well, they could, but MPs are now under much greater scrutiny, and rightly so. As I said before, I think we sort of slightly sort of dropped the ball on overseeing what Lords were up to and the links between lobbyists and peers.
Well, it's interesting. Whenever Britain's talking to third world countries about how to organise their governance or the Soros Foundation, Western institutions like that, they go around and say, unless you pay politicians properly, they won't do a proper job and they'll be corrupt. But then you think, well, we're not doing it here in the heart of Westminster.
Well, then you get into the question of, well, what is a fair salary for a politician? Because in some parties, predominantly a Conservative Party, clearly, you know, a lot of those people can be earning very large salaries indeed as non-executive directors on several boards at the same time, etc., etc. Should their salary be equivalent to an NHS doctor or, you know, a GP or a teacher?
And some of these
guys
would certainly help if we fixed an MP to a certain cadre of the civil service and we said that's the fixed rate and that's right. Why, you know, whether it's permanent secretaries or wherever you want to fix it. And then at least there's a reason why, and they don't have to vote on their own salaries all the time. And I think you could do the same. You'd have a very small House of Lords, a small Senate that was elected in one form or another. And I think that would deal with the question. But, you know, people will always cheat if they can, and you just have to keep on the case.
But, Will, what do you think? I mean, Polly's saying and Matt's saying that it's time to just elect it and have done with. Not long ago, bleeding heart Liberals, like all of us, were very pleased with the House of Lords because it had vetoed the government's 42 days plan. If we packed it with more party placemen who were scared of the crack of the government whip, wouldn't we find it was just doing the Commons bidding and then we'd be worried about that as well?
Yes, I mean, I personally think there's probably a way you could do it with a single chamber. I think, with greater time spent on legislation, perhaps giving MPs extended research capability, building up their offices, and having a much more effective committee system to revise legislation. But I think this case does absolutely show that the idea of nominated peers being a big improvement on the hereditary system has just been completely exposed by this. And you have people like Lord Taylor, who was essentially sort of given his job as a reward for good service under Callaghan. And the Moonies and Snapes of this world are the same for Blair. And what you'll get is the Moonies and Snapes and their ilk 30 years later will turn up in some sort of scandal, just as Taylor is. I mean, nobody outside the House of Lords has heard of Taylor for 31 years.
When you walk around the House of Lords, it's a living museum. Suddenly there are people you thought long dead. Good heavens, there's so-and-so from the Callaghan era.
I read their obituary.
Yes, exactly. And you think that they've gone, but there they are forever and ever. I think the real issue here is that we just have to ban all lobbying and all working for outside interests from both the Commons and the Lords and be done with it. There isn't a clear line between what's a consultancy, an advisor, and what's lobbying. It's plainly the wrong thing. As Will said, the only reason they get asked to do it is because they might have influence and we don't want them to have.
I love the talk of Moonies and Snapes. It sounds like a plot from Harry Potter.
The Moonies and Snapes.
Who's Voldemort?
Now, as the credit crisis crunches on, we turn to our tough-talking boffin, Deborah Hargreaves, to kick off our new series, Recession Watch, picking out the financial lowlights of the week.
Recession Watch.
The theme we've seen this week really has been jobs or the lack of them. We saw the worst day of this downturn so far on Monday, with up to 80,000 job losses announced worldwide from some very big companies, most of them in the US, but also a lot of job losses in the UK. We've seen midweek the International Labour Organization coming out with an absolutely appalling forecast that up to 50 million jobs could be lost worldwide this year if we go into a very severe downturn. And as if that wasn't bad enough, on the same day the IMF has suggested that world growth would only be 0.5% this year, and that's downgrading a previous forecast for 2.2% growth. So it's doom and gloom all round. But we shouldn't really worry, because directors at Lloyds Bank, which obviously has just been bailed out by the government owns now 44% of that bank, but that hasn't actually stopped the directors from wanting to award themselves a pay rise. We found out this week, and this was a story that The Guardian broke, that directors had canvassed their other shareholders, excluding the government, to pay very generous bonus schemes for their executive directors. Let's remember here that the chief exec of Lloyds already earns over £1 million, and most of the other directors are on packages of £500,000 to £600,000. The shareholders, of course, told them that was a very bad idea, the government wouldn't be too pleased about that, and to go and sound out the government. They've now rather rowed back on that scheme, but it does show that bankers are rather living in a bit of a parallel universe.
Deborah Hargreaves. Well, Polly, you've written a whole book on fat cats. Did your research teach you to understand bankers' lack of shame?
I think I'm surprised that there's been absolutely no sense of remorse at all by any of them. None have come forward and apologised. None of them have said we got things wrong. Even Alan Greenspan has said just a little. But, I mean, really, it's quite remarkable how much they don't think there's a culture change. And if we're not careful, there won't be one, because they'll just wait a couple of years and then back in the saddle and off they gallop again. I think it's very important that there is a sense of real public outrage. They still are taking these vast salaries. I mean, the guy who's taken over at RBS, getting himself $750,000 a year plus $1.5 million bonus, and that's only for a part-time job, and he's also part-time chair of Sainsbury's and gets another $400,000 a year. And this is thought to be normal. Oh, it's about average, they said. Well, you know, what do we mean average? Why don't we start saying, let's say nobody earns more than what the Prime Minister earns, at least for the moment, that's around $190,000. perfectly enough to run a big organisation.
And a nationalised organisation.
And a nationalised organisation. I don't see any reason why people who are employees of public companies should expect any more than that, different if you're a private entrepreneur, but not employees.
I mean, Will, what do you think? I'm just struck the politics of it seem blindingly obvious. People can see that next year their tax is going to go up, their national insurance is going to go up. They know that their money's going into the bank. And then they're watching the people who are in charge of it ask for even more money than the astronomical salaries they're already on. I mean, do you think it will happen, or do you think public anger will get in the way?
Well, I think there is huge amounts of public anger out there, but I mean, clearly in certain cases, these people are going to be immune to it. I mean, they seem to have, looks like they've stopped it in this particular case that Deb was talking about, but I don't know if that can carry on. But I mean, Barack Obama said, I think virtually in his first day at the White House, there's going to be a pay freeze on all senior White House staff. It does feel like we need a similar measure here, which goes not just in government, but if you like, situations like the banks, which are substantially owned by the government now. Sort of public opinion would suggest and want that there to be a similar measure.
Matt, yesterday The Guardian ran an editorial saying that there should be a maximum wage, or at least floating the idea. And this, I don't think, was just about the banks and with the now nationalised banks and the rest of the public sector, but more generally, do you think things are in flux to the point where we could find ourselves with something like that when we come out of this slump in a couple of years' time?
I'd love it if we could turn back the clock. Even in the United States, you know, the sort of birthplace of sort of turbo capitalism in many ways, you know, if you go back to the 60s, it was considered unacceptable for the chair or chief executive's salary to be more than a certain multiple of, you know, the average salary in a firm. And, you know, we're so detached from that now. I'm not sure if we can roll back the clock. What I do think is that we haven't got to the bottom of how to establish some better system of public accountability for the fat cats, for these executives who are still expecting to collect their terrific bonuses. It seems clear to me, I mean, Will was talking earlier about building up the sort of committee structure in the House of Parliament. Mm. And, you know, when you look at congressional committees and the way they operate in the United States, you can really pull those people like Dick Fuld in front of the senators and congressmen and women and, you know, really make them answer some tough questions. It doesn't seem to me that, you know, listening to the yesterday in Parliament, that listening to the proceedings of a select Treasury Committee, that you're really getting that kind of value for money if you want to. And perhaps we need a public inquiry. I don't know.
But, I mean, do people want inquiries and people hauled over the coal or something? It's always satisfying to see someone who you're annoyed with being grilled, Polly. But do you think people actually want something done in statutory terms rather than just accountability that Matt's talking about?
I think there's real outrage, particularly against bankers. But I think there is a sense, and as more and more people lose their jobs, you know, wait in a year's time and another million people may have lost their jobs, that the people who caused this have walked away and are still earning colossal salaries, and with no remorse at all for those who've lost their whole livelihoods, maybe their homes. I don't know how that's going to be channeled, but I think it's quite a dangerous situation if none of our politicians actually seem to be speaking in those terms, don't voice that outrage. You hear very little of it, very muted from either Brown or Darling, and they really need to do it. I mean, the Tories aren't likely to do it, or in a very weak way. Lib Dems are a quiet voice, and Vince Cable does it well, but they don't seem to be making much headway. And I just think there ought to be movement out of there of people with their saucepans clattering outside some of these city institutions, outside the homes of some of these fat cats, just saying, up with this, we will not put. And the politicians would then have to respond. Actually, a relatively small number of people who took action in that way, because it would have huge public resonance, could make a big difference. Maybe we should do it.
Will you be joining the barricade?
Well, I mean, to go back to, in a way, to the story we were last talking about, I mean, I've always been under the impression that you can't apply, retrospective punishment. And it appears, say, with the Lords, that the Leader of Lords is looking at doing that for these four Lord. I simply don't know whether it's possible to impose retrospective punishment on the bankers, like an individual windfall tax on some of these guys.
You wouldn't have to. This isn't a case of punishing them. It's a question of whether their salary going forward and paid by the taxpayer should be maintained at the level.
That's what matters. I mean, so Fred Goodwin, Fred the Shred, well, he's walked off with his enormous load of money. The question is, how do we stop it? How do we change the culture going on from here for everybody in these jobs, still earning these hundreds and hundreds of thousands and millions?
But, I mean, is it presumably these people now say they're going to be able to clean up the mess left by the Fred the Shreds? I mean, the Shreds have gone, have they? There's just no way of touching them.
Probably. I mean, I think it's quite hard to have retrospective legislation. It'd be very sticky. They'd probably stack it all in Zug by now or Luxembourg or somewhere. I think, and in a sense, that's not the point. The point is, how do we change from now on? And that's where I see very little wish of the government to say, let's have a high pay commission that at least sets benchmarks for public companies and for shareholders. There is no shareholder activism. Shareholder democracy does not exist. It's a complete sham and fraud. We need some of that revived.
And you think it's that kind of setting of benchmarks rather than changing the law or very high tax rates at the top that would probably
do the job?
You could
start that way, couldn't you? You could begin by saying shareholders should hold to account any company that's paying its top people, say, more than 15% of its average workforce. Start like that. And if they're paying, as they are now, 75 times, it really gives shareholders a reason to or an obligation to question. And it begins to become a big story. And I think you start with that. And if it doesn't work, then you move to the law.
Well, we're going to have to stop calling time on fat cat bonuses and instead call time on Politics Weekly itself. As ever, those with big political appetites can fill up at any time at guardian.co.uk/politics. And you can leave your thoughts on today's programme on Will Woodward's own politics blog. Thanks to all my guests, Polly Toynbee, Matt Seaton and Will Woodward. Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Tom Clark, and until next week, goodbye.